You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma-Louise Fenlon.
Hello, and welcome to the Christmas edition of LawPod UK. We've gathered around the metaphorical fire here in Chambers, and here with me to provide a selection box of the most exciting cases from 2018 is Jonathan Metzer. John, welcome.
Lovely to be here.
Kicking things off, we're going to begin with Darnley, a case which will be of particular concern to hospital receptionists.
Yes, this case involved a man who was taken to A&E after suffering a very serious assault. And like many people who go to A&E, he was very disappointed to see that there were a lot of other people at the hospital as well. He was told by the receptionist that he could expect to have a 4 to 5 hour wait. I personally have some sympathy with what he did next, which was to give up and decide to leave the hospital. But that turned out to be a very bad decision indeed, because he then suffered a catastrophic decline, which the question for the court was it the hospital's fault?
And so what did the court find?
The court ended up finding for the claimant. What has happened was that the receptionist at A&E had simply got it wrong. Actually, the situation was that he really ought to have been seen within half an hour because it was a serious case. And that would have happened had he stayed at the hospital for long enough. The Court of Appeal had said that nevertheless, there wasn't a duty of care. Essentially, the issue of whether there's a duty of care is usually the big question when courts have to decide whether or not there is going to be negligence liability for what is a relatively novel situation. And it's well established that doctors and nurses will owe a duty of care to their patients. The question was, would a receptionist be in the same category? And the Supreme Court ended up saying that the receptionist was. Lord Lloyd-Jones was the one who gave the main judgment, and he explains that there is a duty that the hospital has to take reasonable care not to cause physical injury. And once the claimant had come to A&E, he had entered into a relationship of patient and healthcare provider. And what that meant was that the receptionist had to take reasonable care to avoid causing him injury. And it was held that it was negligent to give him that incorrect advice about his waiting time.
Owen Thomas wrote about the Supreme Court decision and also recently recorded a podcast on this. In his analysis, he points out that there were few crumbs of comfort for the defendants, particularly the frank recognition by the Supreme Court that it is undoubtedly the fact that hospital A&E departments operate in very difficult circumstances and under colossal pressure. This is a consideration which may well prove highly influential in many cases where assessing whether there has been a negligent breach of duty. I suppose what's surprising is that despite a statement like that, they still found the hospital receptionist negligent.
Yes, it's very interesting. As lawyers know, simply making a mistake is not the same as negligence. And what this decision means is not that every person who gives incorrect advice in an A&E situation will now be breaching a duty of care. It simply moves the question down. Instead of assessing whether there is a duty of care, there's likely to be more cases that will involve a question of whether there was an actual breach of duty. And in this case, it was considered that the receptionist ought to have taken more care. What the court said was that the standard required is that of an averagely competent and well-informed person performing the function of a receptionist, which is quite a long way around of saying essentially a reasonable receptionist doing a reasonable job. In this case, they felt that the receptionist hadn't done that. In another case, it's possible that there would have been a different result.
Moving on to another area of law and another jurisdiction completely, everybody following human rights law will be aware that abortion has been in the news much lately, especially off the back of the Irish referendum in May, which legalised abortion. Stark contrast, then, in the facts of the case involving the abortion ban in Northern Ireland. John, hopefully you're going to tell us the complicated way in which the Supreme Court managed to dodge this particular question.
Yes, of course. This case really is big stuff. This is the kind of thing which really makes headlines when courts have to decide the question of whether the ban on abortion is compatible with human rights. The interesting thing about this case was that the Supreme Court relied on the identity of the claimant as a way to decide the case against them. The claim was brought on the basis that the general prohibition on abortion in all cases is incompatible with several human rights, most importantly the right to private and family life, but also the prohibition on inhuman and degrading treatment. And in the High Court, it had been held that the criminalisation of abortion for a case of a fatal fetal abnormality or rape or incest up until the point at which the fetus was capable of being born alive was incompatible with Article 8. Court of Appeal in Northern Ireland went the other way, and they said that no, the general prohibition on abortion doesn't give rise to any incompatibility. And the Human Rights Commission of Northern Ireland took the case to London because the Supreme Court is also the Supreme Court in Northern Ireland as well. By a 4-3 majority, the judges said that the claim would fail because the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission did not have what's called legal standing to bring the proceedings. Legal standing has usually been regarded as something of a relic in English and Welsh public law. There's a lot of cases which the law students listening today will probably be very familiar with, but perhaps the practitioners will be less familiar with, concerning the circumstances in which a claimant for judicial review will or won't have standing. The reason that perhaps many practitioners will be less familiar with that line of case law is that the end result tends towards the view that standing isn't normally a legal issue. Essentially, the courts have come to the position that normally you take the case on its merits rather than looking at the identity of who's bringing the claim. Not so in this case. Instead, what the majority said was that there has to be an actual or potential victim to the unlawful act, and it was considered that this claimant was not such a victim because they're an organisation rather than an individual. I find that a very surprising conclusion, because it seems to me that, of course, there have to be actual and potential victims of the legislation, given that it's regulating the question every day as to whether an individual can or can't have an abortion in Northern Ireland.
It's particularly disappointing for those who would like to see the women in Northern Ireland have the same rights as the women in England and Wales and now in the Republic of Ireland. Because, of course, the majority, a differently constituted majority, then found that, in fact, the ban does, in different ways, violate human rights, and that perhaps, in different circumstances, this decision could have gone another way.
That's right. And, of course, they didn't need to. Once they'd decided by majority that the claim had to fail, they could have just stopped there. But instead, the judges did decide to express their views on whether or not the legislation was compatible with human rights. And the majority said that if they had determined the merits of the claim, they would have found that there was incompatibility with Article 8 in the case where abortion is prohibited for a victim of rape, a situation where there's been incest, and a situation where there is a fatal fetal abnormality. The judges each set out different reasoning as to how they'd got here. It's a very interesting decision because it's clear that the judges felt very passionately about the issues at stake. Perhaps that's another reason why it's surprising that they took what some people have regarded as the easy way out by saying that they didn't need to decide the claim at all.
Reading the judgment itself, it's clear that many of the members of the majority felt very strongly about this. For example, Lord Kerr's statement, paragraph 261 of the judgment, says the following: "The girls and women of Northern Ireland are forbidden to do to their own bodies that which they wish to do. They are prevented from arranging their lives in the way that they want. They are denied the chance to shape their future as they desire. If, as well as the curtailment on their autonomy, which this involves, they are carrying a fetus with a fatal abnormality or have been the victims of rape or incest, they are condemned because legislation in another era has decreed it to endure untold suffering and desolation. What is that if it is not humiliation and debasement?"
Yes, I think that's very admirable sentiment. He made that remark because he also felt, as well as private and family life, this was also incompatible with Article 3, the prohibition on inhuman and degrading treatment. And we're familiar with the conception that something like physical torture is a breach of Article 3, but it seems to me that we should also keep in mind that something like this, which has a profound effect on a person's autonomy and how they can live the rest of their lives, is also something which we should take very seriously when we think about whether they're being subject to degrading treatment or not. Another interesting aspect of this case is in Lord Mance's judgment, because he quoted polling by Amnesty International, which said that a majority of people considered that abortion should be allowed in cases of rape, incest, and fatal fetal abnormality. For him, this was a relevant consideration when turning to the question of whether the interference in Article 8 that the legislation created was necessary in a democratic society. This is probably a subject for a much deeper and more detailed podcast, but it seems to me to be a fascinating question as to when and how judges should take into account the views of the public. They're not politicians, but at the same time, they are being asked to deal with questions which are intimately involved in deep political questions.
Of particular interest to immigration practitioners in a year in which the hostile environment of UKBA policies made the news and the Windrush scandal exploded, is this case of KO Nigeria. And obviously that's one that's right up your alley, it being immigration law.
This case is about how a tribunal should evaluate whether a child and their parents should be expected to leave the UK if they don't have immigration status. It's quite common in a situation like that for the claimants to rely on their rights under Article 8 to private and family life. Essentially, claimants will say that removing them from the UK is a disproportionate interference in their Article 8 rights. The question is, how should the court deal with a situation where we've got parents and children? In more detail, in considering whether the child should be expected to leave, even if it's in their best interests to remain, should the tribunal weigh against them any criminality or other misconduct by their parents?
I think in reference to that particular point, you quoted from the Bible, I believe, "The son shall not suffer for the iniquity of the father, nor the father suffer for the iniquity of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon himself." Of course, the KO judgment was not nearly as straightforward and clear as that particular statement, was it?
You're absolutely right. That sentiment from Ezekiel does run through this judgment like a golden thread. And indeed, the judgment relies heavily on a previous Supreme Court decision in a case called Zumbas, which sets out a principle that a child must not be blamed for matters for which he or she is not responsible, such as the conduct of the parents. But the more difficult question is, if the tribunal has to decide whether removing the child is reasonable, does the conduct of the parents affect that wider assessment? It had looked as though the tribunal should take that matter into account. The Supreme Court said no, it isn't compatible with the Ezekiel principle, and instead, you have to undertake an exercise that is focused on the position of the child rather than looking at what the parents may or may not have done.
Our final case, which will be known to many, is the case of DSD and the Commissioner for the Metropolitan Police, better known as the case involving the black cab rapist, John Warboys. Jonathan, can you tell us a little bit about what this case involved?
As our listeners probably know, John Warboys was a London black cab driver who committed a vast number of really nasty sexual offences against women between 2003 and 2008. The victims claimed that the police had failed to undertake a proper investigation, and what that meant was that they had been exposed to inhuman and degrading treatment under Article 3. What's really interesting about this case is that human rights law is really about the relationship between the state and the individual. This was a situation where the acts which were complained of, the inhuman and degrading acts, were committed by a private citizen. And what that meant was that the court had to examine whether the state's duty to prevent a private citizen from committing inhuman and degrading acts had been breached in this case.
For me, the judgment recalled the case of Michael and others, another Supreme Court decision from 2015, in which was held that police were not liable in negligence to the victim of domestic violence. But in that case, they did allow the Article 2 claim to proceed. And I suppose both of these claims are an example of how human rights law can be very powerful in protecting the rights of, in particular, women from abusive partners or abusive strangers, but how common law is often not particularly powerful in doing the same.
Absolutely. The courts tend to take the view that the job done by human rights law is different from the job done by negligence law. It's very difficult to win against the police in damages for negligence, though there was a case of that this year, which we're not going to talk about, but you can find on the article that will accompany this podcast. However, human rights law is a better tool for examining whether the police have done what they should do in an individual case. The way that the claim was structured was that it was argued that the reports of what John Warboys was doing created a positive duty on the part of the police to take reasonable steps to protect the victims from him. And given that the police had failed to do that, the court came to the view that there was a breach of Article 3 in this case. So the state was responsible for inhuman and degrading treatment committed by a private citizen.
And obviously around the same time, listeners will remember the decision concerning DSD and the parole board, in which it was ruled that the parole board's decision to direct the release of John Warboys should be quashed.
Yes, another very interesting decision, but I'm afraid we don't have time for that today. You will have to go onto the UK Human Rights blog if you want to learn about that one.
One case that didn't make it into John's list, but deserves a mention before we finish, is a judgment recently handed down in relation to Douglas Slade. Listeners may or may not be familiar with this case. It's not strictly human rights, but it's an excellent example of how tort law can overhaul the rights of others in countries outside of the UK. In that particular judgment, Douglas Slade was ordered to pay the victims of child abuse following abuse committed in the Philippines. It's groundbreaking because it's the first time that a paedophile in the UK with assets will have to face consequences for child abuse committed abroad. I should say that it was fought by a member of One Crown Office Row, Justin Levinson, and hopefully will open the floodgates for more claims in the future in the best possible way. Thanks for coming on the podcast, John.
It's been a pleasure.
And we'd like to wish all of our listeners happy holidays, and we hope you'll keep listening in the new year.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenelon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.